about what the theory is all about, and what some of the evidence is for it, and then how we can use it to explain a lot of things that we see around us on the earth. Okay, all right. And my name is Jill Whitman, and I, as you may have read or seen, I teach in the Earth Science Department. And my interests are actually in plate tectonics as a field of research, and then in oceanography, sort of the two combined. I'm going to start actually by showing a slide that sort of wakes us all up as to why we might care about plate tectonics. This is the very famous 8:32 a.m. on the 18th of May in 1980. Yeah. Mount St. Helens, and plate tectonics, which is a theory which really only has evolved over the last 30 years, now gives us a means to explain why such an event happened in this location, and why it's not likely to happen in other locations as well. To start out, just briefly, in terms of the theory, what science has decided is that it works very well to explain the Earth in terms of a series of plates which cover the Earth. And these plates all move relative to one another. And where the plates come in contact with each other, we then have the ability to see that something must be happening. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the evidence for this and then come back and look at what happens at different kinds of plate boundaries. You can see that the names of the plates are often related to something geographic. So we have the North American plate, and we have the Pacific plate. It's amazing in a class when I ask the students to label the plates, how they can't manage to label the North American plate the North American plate, even when it's given as a multiple choice. Unfortunately, the other beef I have about geography at the school level. We can see that the edges of the plates don't necessarily coincide with the edges of the continents. And in particular, the North American plate extends all the way out into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And that's something that I think is hard to separate in our minds. We think of continents as very different from what's going on in the oceans, and that's true. But this whole plate can move as a single piece together. And where these plates come in contact is where things happen. And so we'll look at what some of these things are. As I said, the theory is really only about 30 years old. It evolved in the 1960s from a lot of information that had been gathered in the previous decades, but the real cornerstone piece didn't fall into place until the mid-1960s. And yet, when it is taught in the school systems today, it is taught as the gospel truth. And I like to remind people that, in fact, it's a theory. There's a lot of evidence to support the theory. But in two more centuries, there may be something else which explains it better. I am just old enough, although to my college students I think I seem ancient, I'm just old enough to have gone to high school before plate tectonics was being taught. And yet now in the high schools, everybody would teach it as what is happening. I put a couple of names up here, and you can look at them later. What I like to do when I look at the evidence that was collected for plate tectonics was to look at it very historically, and to look at sort of what were the early types of evidence, and talk a little bit about the response to that, and then how the theory developed. And from these names here, the first one I have is Alfred Wegener. In 1912, he was a German, he was actually a meteorologist, and he was the one who first suggested this idea, which he actually was called continental drift, rather than what we now call plate tectonics. And he's the one who said, hey, look, this jigsaw puzzle that we can do if we put the continents back together again. And this is then a very famous fit that was constructed in the early 60s, but that takes South America and Africa and North America and Europe and moves them all back together again. And we see at this point that the lineup is really incredible in terms of how the continents fit back together again. And Wegener was one who said that this looked like it was a possibility. You can see there's a few areas where there's gaps in the case of the black, and there's other areas where there's overlaps. The overlaps tend to be much easier to explain. We have the Amazon Delta built out here and the Congo Delta built out here. And so if we take the material away that's accumulated on those deltas, then we don't end up with that kind of an overlap. But Wegener went much further than just this jigsaw puzzle idea. He said he spent a lot of time as a meteorologist studying evidence of ancient climates. And in trekking around in the continents of the Southern Hemisphere, he found a lot of evidence geologically that linked in with the things that he was looking for climates. And he found that there was a very good link between that information on the two different continents. And this is just showing that if we look at South America and Africa back together again, that there are certain kinds of things distributed in the geology in the rocks which actually link up. And we can see that very similar rock types are found which would be adjacent to each other if the continents were back together again. And this is also true in terms of structure. We can see that there's this huge area, I can't remember actually the details of what the green is versus the orange, but this huge structure which shows up here in Africa, and there was this very small section of it out here in South America, and it was a problem for geologists to say, well, how do we end up with just this very small piece of it? But then when we bring it back together, we find that in fact it all fits together as a single piece. And this also showed up in the fossil record. When we look at the distribution of fossils on the Earth at times in the past, we find that a species is distributed and then sort of radiates out from that one location. And the problem was that people looked and saw the distribution of fossils on South America and on Africa and even over into Antarctica and Australia, and they found that this species was present on both of these continents. Well, this was a big critter. This wasn't something that could be blown all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. And when they were talking somewhere in the vicinity of 3,000 or 4,000 miles of travel, it was very difficult to explain how these critters could have traveled this distance. And so when Wegener suggested that these continents had all drifted apart from a position together, it gave a much better solution to the paleontologist problem of how there was this difference in distribution on the continents. And one of the things that this points out is that in the Southern Hemisphere, not only did we have the South American Africa jigsaw puzzle, which is one that is somewhat evident when you look at the shapes of the continents, but that India fit into here and Antarctica and Australia as well. This also showed up in terms of the ancient climate markers that Wegener was looking for. We can look and find evidence of here, this green area is the tropical region, and he found that there was evidence for tropics that was distributed all the way across on these different continents for some time, maybe 300 million years ago, and yet in the present day these continents were very separate, and in fact this latitude here that we see along the margin of North America we know extends from very low latitudes up to very high latitudes, and how could we have tropical fauna living at what is presently 50 or 55 degrees north. And the same thing is true. There's coal deposits. Coal is usually associated with low latitudes. And then also there's evidence of glaciation on all of these continents. And we can look at that more specifically. Wegener was very interested in evidence of glaciation. Wegener himself actually died on Greenland while doing exploration of high latitude meteorology. But one of the things that people had found was when they looked on these continents, they found markers that showed that there had been glaciation there in the past. And we see that in terms of the rock types which are deposited, but also the grooves that glaciers can leave on the surface. And people using these grooves said that, well, the glaciers traveled in these directions that the arrows mark. Well, how did you have a glacier which traveled from the ocean onto the continent? Since glaciers move under the influence of gravity, we would expect them to be moving the other direction. And this was one of the things that when the continents are reassembled, this then gives a source for the glaciers in a higher region, which could then have traveled outward, both from the central part of Africa and also from Antarctica out onto Australia. Now this was glaciation, which took place somewhere on the order of about 350 million years ago. And yet the evidence is still there today to show that the glaciers have traveled in that path. Now, by the time Wegener assembled all of his information and published it in a work in 1912, he said, well, the continents must have moved. The continents must have all drifted from their past positions, and yet there was not enough in the way of physical understanding of the Earth to explain how this could possibly have happened. And he just said, well, the continents just kind of plowed through the oceans to their new positions. And as a result of that, he was really shot down, and his books were put on the shelves and really not looked at again for many decades. And the whole idea just went back onto the back burner. Some people said, well, we have an expanding Earth, and so that's how we've moved these continents apart. Well, it wasn't until post-Second World War time that new information was collected to really give us a whole other level of understanding about the Earth. Up until that time, all of the study of geology had basically taken place on land. And the technology which was developed in the Second World War, in particular because of the advent of submarine warfare, gave a whole new method to study the ocean basins. And the other person who really was one of the two grandfathers of plate tectonics was a man named Harry Hess, who actually served in the Navy during the Second World War and spent a lot of time in the ships looking at the records that came back when sound was bounced down to the seafloor. And he was not interested in whether there were submarines there, although that's what he was being paid to do. He was far more interested in looking at what the shape of the seafloor was. And as a result of cruises during the 40s and 50s, geologists were able to put together a map which gives us an artist's rendition of what the seafloor looks like. And I try to remind everyone that this is really the artist's name was Marie Tharp, and this is really her rendition of what it looked like. But it helps us to see some of the features which are there, which we know are there from studies of the depth of the seafloor, although they probably don't look exactly like this if we were to drain out all the water from the ocean basin. One of the most dramatic features that shows up is what we call the ridges that are found throughout the world's ocean basins. And unfortunately, I don't seem to be able to get all of the map into focus simultaneously. These are regions which are elevated relative to the surrounding seafloor. And we can actually trace a ridge all the way down through the center of the Atlantic, comes up and sort of forms a Y in Indian Ocean, and comes all the way up again here into the Pacific, and then re-emerges here just off the northwest coast of North America. And these ridges generally have an average depth at their crest, which I always think of in terms of meters, but I'll translate. It's about 250 meters depth, which then gives us a depth to the top of the ridges on the order of about a mile and a half. The surrounding seafloor drops down in many of these flatter regions to something that's on the order of 2.5 to 3 miles of depth. And then the other dramatic features which were observed were the trenches, which show up as these very dark areas here. And the trenches reach depths, the deepest one in particular being the Mariana Trench, located over here, of a depth of close to 7 miles. And so these show up as very prominent features, but very isolated features. The ridges we find sort of tracing throughout the ocean basins, but the trenches are these very dramatic features where the depth drops off very steeply down to some maximum depth, and these were obviously very interesting as potential hideouts for the submarines that they were looking for. And after putting together these kinds of maps, Harry Hess wrote an article which was published, which he actually titled Geopoetry. And he took the Wegener idea that the continents had moved relative to each other, and he moved a step further and said, well, something's happening in the oceans. And he called this whole process seafloor spreading. And what he said was, if we have a ridge in the middle of an ocean basin, this is a place where we're creating new material at the surface of the Earth. And the ocean is then spreading apart from those ridges in the centers of the ocean basins. Now, that presents a problem. That means that things are growing. And he then said, well, if we look at an ocean basin such as this one, and we're spreading and creating new material, that material is traveling away from that ridge. At some point, we have to be destroying material in order to keep a balance. And the trenches are the place where this is happening. And there was a lot of information being assembled at that time, studies of changes in very small scale amounts of gravity on the surface of the Earth, which also were able to support this kind of an idea that somehow we're forcing material back down into the Earth at these trenches. So we're going to talk a lot more about what's happening at the ridges and trenches, but it was Hess who, from this information which was gathered during the 40s and 50s, put together in 1962 his geo-poetry. The response was better than the response of Indivagar. But the response was still not terrific. People needed to be convinced that somehow something was happening at these ridges, that we really were creating new material. And the real cornerstone that came along at this point was the study of magnetism as it's preserved in rocks. And it turns out that scientists first started looking at this whole pattern here in the Hawaiian Islands, and they looked at lava flows exposed in the Hawaiian Islands and discovered that the polarity, the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field has not stayed constant at the present through time. At the present, our North Pole, our North Geographic Pole, actually happens to coincide with a South Magnetic Pole, but I won't confuse you with that. We have a pole at the northern part of the Earth. The magnetic pole actually is not exactly the same location as the geographic pole, but if we go back a million years ago, that North Magnetic Pole was down at the other end, at the southern pole. And this flip-flop has happened about every million years for the last 70 million years. And so scientists started going out and documenting this flip-flop on rocks on the surface of the Earth. So they'd find one layer where the rocks were all pointing north, and they'd find a layer on top of that where they were all pointing south, and so on. Well, that worked on the surface of the Earth. But the next thing that people needed to do was put this into the ocean basins. And it was a paper actually by a graduate student at Cambridge University. Lucky guy, he sort of gave him his key to fame for the rest of his life, who studied the magnetism as it was recorded in the rocks from the ocean basins. And so here they weren't looking at layers of one on top of each other, but here they were looking at a trend that was recorded across the center of an ocean basin, across the ridge. And their study actually was not from this area just south of Iceland, but this is one of the real classic areas which is shown because the pattern is very good. And one of the ways that we show this reversal in polarity of the magnetic field is to color things black and white to show the flip-flop. And so we see a trend along the ridge itself where the rocks have what we call normal polarity, pointing in the direction where we know the Earth's magnetic pole is today. And then we see bands on either side of that are white, which is this period of reverse polarity. And you can see if you squint that you see this pattern of the positive and negative or normal and reverse polarity moving out parallel to the ridge, on both sides of the ridge, in fact. And it was Vine and his graduate advisor, Matthews, who put the last paper in, sort of that sealed up this idea for people that maybe the theory of plate tectonics could, in fact, work. Because here we see evidence that we have young rocks here, and if we move out slightly, we have slightly older rocks. And if we go out even further, we see that they must be increasing in age, because there's this flip-flop of polarity. And just to sort of show a schematic illustration of how this works, if we look at the first step here, we're creating rock at the ridge, and it's taking on the present-day polarity, and then as that material moves away from the ridge, that strip then is divided in half, and new rock comes in between with reverse polarity, and we then see that as it continues to move out, we're constantly adding new material, and so we end up with these stripes. Now, why aren't they perfectly linear stripes? Well, the lava's flowing out, and it's sort of making puddles here and there. Everything is not perfect in geology anyhow, so that we're not ending up with straight lines. But this piece of information, which was published in a couple of papers in 64 and 65, then really put this information together. Now, they were very lucky that in 1968, for the first time, the Glomar Challenger sailed as a research ship to go out and drill sediments from the seafloor all over the world. And the Glomar Challenger had an interesting mandate that if they encountered anything that equaled a natural resource, such as oil or gas, they had to immediately seal up that hole. So this was entirely for research purposes, and the Glomar Challenger was not the ship that brought up the Russian submarine. That was the Glomar Explorer, which was one of her sister ships. So the Challenger was out there only for an international cooperative research project. But what they did on their very first cruise was come down in here into the southern part of the Atlantic Ocean and drill sediments here across the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And they discovered that when they went and drilled the sediments, which are found immediately overlying the rock of the seafloor, that those sediments got older as one went away from the ridge, giving yet another piece of supporting evidence to say that, in fact, we have new material at the crest of the ridge, and as it moves away, it becomes older and older. Now, there were a lot of other kinds of evidence which were assembled during that decade and even subsequently to add some support. One of the things we find is that we can now date the seafloor all the way out throughout the ocean basins, and it gets older and older and older as we move away from the ridge crests. We find something else interesting, which is that if we measure the heat flow on the surface of the Earth, it's very warm along the ridges. Very warm is a minuscule deviation from normal, but it's much cooler out here by the time we come down to the trenches. And that's suggesting this idea that we have new material coming up here, forming rock, and then it ages and cools before it goes down into the Earth. One of the other things which has really solidified this idea of tectonics and the division of the Earth into plates is that we can document the outlines of our plates based on the distribution of earthquakes on the surface of the Earth. And what we see here is that there's earthquakes, and they're showing there are three different colors of red and green and blue. Shallow earthquakes are red, and then blue, they get deeper. But what we see is that, looking at the overall distribution, that earthquakes are really limited to very narrow bands. And these bands then coincide with these features that Hess had described as being places where things were happening. The ridges have earthquakes associated with them, and then the trenches. And basically, the Pacific is just ringed by trenches. And we see trenches along the coast of South America, up here in this region, a little bit, but when we come up into the Aleutians, a big trench down here along the peninsula is associated with the Soviet Union, down off Japan, the trenches actually split here around a very small plate, and then come down all the way here down through New Zealand. So this distribution of earthquakes says something must be happening at certain locations and not at other locations. And this gave scientists the ability to then give outlines to these plates where they thought the things were happening at the boundaries and not in the middle of them. You can see that there's exceptions. Hawaii has some earthquakes associated with it because of the volcanism there. Eastern part of North America is a big enigma why there's some earthquakes there. In the Rocky Mountains, we see earthquakes as well. But in general, the distribution of these earthquakes is limited to very narrow bands.
How did the end of the plates relate to what we call tectonic faults, like or coast of California?
I'm going to come to that. Basically, what we have are three types of plate boundaries. We have places where plates are moving apart from one another, and that is what's happening at the ridges, and we call these divergent plate boundaries. The plates are diverging from one another. We have places where the plates are coming back together towards one another, converging, so these are called convergent plate boundaries, usually associated with both trenches and mountains. And then if you think about the geometry of the whole thing, you also have to have places where plates are sliding past one another. And so those are transform plate boundaries, and we'll come back and we'll look at the characteristics of each of those. I wanted to start by looking at the divergent plate boundaries because this is where the new thing is happening, where material is being created. And this kind of cross-section schematic gives us a little summary of what's happening at both divergent and convergent plate boundaries. But we can start here by looking at a divergent plate boundary. Basically, what we have in cross-section are two plates which are moving apart from one another. And something is making them move. One of the great debates in geology and geophysics right now is the stuff pushing up, making them move apart, or is the cold material sinking here, pulling them apart, and something has to come in and fill it. But either way, we know that we have hot, molten material from the interior of the Earth, which is coming up here to the surface, and when it reaches the surface, even though that surface is beneath water, it is still cooling. And then that new material gets added to the edge of these plates and carried out. And then we can see that this is then manifested as this sort of huge underwater mountain range that we call our ridges. Ridges have made big news publicity in the last decade because they've started to discover that these are regions where things are happening very dramatically for very short periods of time, especially short geologically. These are the areas that have sometimes been called the hydrothermal vents or the deep sea hot vents. And what we find is that there are these rock chimneys which are constructed out of which water is coming at temperatures higher than the boiling point. It's not boiling because it's under the pressure of the overlying water. But associated with this extremely hot water and the sulfur contained in that water.
Just a minute, Joe.
Yeah.
Go back to that one. I need to get an idea of how big those things are.
I mean, it doesn't want to back up.
What? Is it just a...
This is a device coming out of an small submarine, Alvin, the two-person submarine, which goes down, and this is, I mean, this is a cord with a plug on the end of it, which is probably only a few inches in diameter. We're then looking at some crabs over here in the distance, which may be as much as 6 inches across or something.
Yeah.
Now, this is actually a fairly small chimney. Some of them are a couple meters in height.
Okay. So
is
that dirt mixed
in the soil? No, it's actually, it's sulfur, which was dissolved in the water that was heated by the heat from the hot material coming up. And as that water then emerges out into the surrounding ambient seawater, the sulfur then precipitates out. You know, sort of in the same way that you can remember you mixed a couple chemicals in a chemistry class and all of a sudden you got white stuff accumulating in the bottom of a test tube. It's the same thing. The chemistry no longer allows the sulfur to be dissolved in the water. When it comes out, it then forms these particulates. But associated with this very hot water, it's in this whole community of organisms never before recovered from the seafloor. These are toothworms. They depend upon sulfur as their main source of energy. And on the surface of the Earth, the sun is the main source of energy. But down here on the seafloor, there is no sun reaching this point. And while there's a small amount of debris that settles down, this community is too dense to be supported by the sunlight food chain, and so this brand new community was discovered, which was dependent upon a new source of energy from the change in chemistry of the sulfur. These tubeworms reach lengths up to a couple meters in length, bright red here because of the chemistry that they have to convert the energy from the sulfur. Also, huge clam fields. These are a whole new species of clams which are discovered. Some of these clams are up to a foot in length. And again, dependent upon the sulfur for their source of energy.
These new organisms, did they bear any relevance to fossil records?
No. In that they don't appear on land. They only exist on the seafloor. And they're very short-lived communities. They are, in terms of their chemical composition, they're composed of elements which tend to dissolve very easily back into the seawater. So after a community dies off, the shells of these clams then just dissolve back into seawater. So they don't tend to be preserved very well. And the worms, for example, don't have any hard parts to show up in the fossil record.
So if they were there, we couldn't find.
That's right. Now, interestingly, the first of these was found in 1980 or 1981. And scientists have revisited that site, and that site has subsequently died off as an active community because it's no longer a source for the sulfur coming out in the hot water. And they see that there's fields of dead giant clams, and then they can go to other areas where there's just a few giant clam shells, and so they think that that was active even longer ago in the past. But these regions only seem to stay active for maybe on the order of 50 or 100 years maximum. So the communities are very short-lived, which presents all sorts of problems in terms of how does the community start up again in another location. But that's biologist's story. Now, another place where we have a ridge, which is forming a new ocean basin, we're now looking at an aerial view. This is Africa and the Arabian Peninsula, and then the rest of the Middle East over here. This is the current part of the world to be looking at. But the Red Sea is an ocean basin which has only been opening for about 20 million years. That's a long time ago. Still growing in size, ridges tend to be creating new material at a rate of about 1 inch to 3 inches a year, which means that every year we get about another inch further away from Europe. One of the interesting anomalies in terms of ridges is Iceland. We can see that Iceland sits here astride the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Iceland then is the only place really on the surface of the earth where we can see a ridge exposed on land. And it's very dramatically exposed in Iceland. We look at, whoa, and my slide sort of slid out of its cover. You can still see a little bit of this. But this is looking along the length of the ridge in Iceland. And these are all very small little volcanoes where new material is making its way to the surface. This has presented a dramatic challenge to the residents of Iceland, particularly in a small island down off the southern coast called Heimaey, where in the 1970s, a volcanic eruption took place very close to the town. And it threatened the town, it threatened to overrun the flow of the lava, threatened to overrun the entire town, and to destroy the village and the port for that village, which was a very important port in terms of the fisheries that went on for the whole country of Iceland. And so they went out and attempted to stop the flow of the lava.
Huh? I read about it.
And they sprayed seawater onto the lava to cool its surface and to divert the path that it flowed along. Yeah, I actually brought this talk along. I've done a whole talk on this. It's a fascinating story. But it shows where human ingenuity came into conflict with nature, and they actually won. And they preserved their port.
For the time being.
Right. Geologically, they probably didn't win, but for that community, they probably did. Now, to go back to these outlines of the plates, we see places where even along these ridges, the ridges are discontinuous in small segments, and that means that if we consider, for example, this plate here, which is the South American plate, and this plate here, which is the African plate, they're moving apart, and along that segment right there, we must just have two plates sliding past one another rather than creating new material or destroying it. Perhaps the best known example of where two plates slide along past one another is here, where the Pacific plate is moving in a northwest direction relative to the North American plate. And in fact, we have one of these plate boundaries, these transform fault plate boundaries, exposed on land as the San Andreas Fault.
So the sliding is not quite so smooth as the word no. sliding might.
No, that's right. It tends to happen in small jumps. And this is an aerial view then of the San Andreas Fault, and a very, very good documentation of the fact that we're looking here at the Pacific Plate and here at the North American Plate. And if we look at these drainage patterns that come down here on the North American Plate, we can find where they once hooked up then over onto the Pacific Plate. And this whole region then is just simply moving northwards relative to this region over here. Now, the 1906 earthquake from San Francisco did this in a very dramatic sense, where it offset a fence. And you can still go to this state park and look at this offset of this fence. And the maximum offset you can see here, when you look at these two people of sort of average height, was somewhere on the order of 4 meters or almost.
Is this the one by the fence over here?
Yeah.
This okay, is I guess.
Part of the fence that was connected to this part of the fence. The San Andreas Fault, we talk about as a single fault. It tends to be a system of faults. And we were dramatically reminded about activity along the system of fault 2 years ago in the fall when there was the earthquake in Loma Prieta, south of San Francisco. There's a wonderful little anecdote that people always talk about. This the north. People always think of California as falling into the ocean, and it's not falling into the ocean. It's simply traveling northwards. The western part of California is traveling northwards relative to the eastern part of California. Los Angeles happens to sit on the Pacific Plate. San Francisco happens to sit on the North American Plate, and that means that Los Angeles is moving northwards relative
to San Francisco. And in somewhere in the order of 40 million years from now, Los Angeles will be a suburb of San Francisco. And the Dodgers and the Giants will once again be crosstown rivals. It's so great to talk to an audience that can appreciate that. I say that to 18-year-olds and they go, huh? But, I mean, I hope to sort of alleviate some of these misconceptions. San Francisco may be falling into, California may be falling into the ocean for other reasons, but it has nothing to do with what's going on geologically. Now, if we come back to convergent plate boundaries, which are these regions where we have trenches, ignore the red dots, they're simply universities that were participating in a study, we see these trenches which ring the Pacific Ocean in particular, and they tell us that this is where we have two plates coming back into contact with one another and, in fact, colliding. We also have this actually happening in a couple of other locations, some of which are not quite as dramatic on the seafloor. India happens to be a separate continent from the rest of Asia. And if you remember back to what you saw in the earthquake distribution, there were a lot of earthquakes around here. And again, we have two plates converging, but here they have continental material on them where they come together. We also have two plates converging here, the large Pacific plate and the small Philippine plate, and that's just oceanic material coming together. But again, there's still a trench associated with that. The other features that we often find associated with convergent plate boundaries are mountain ranges. And the mountain ranges show up in different ways. The Himalayas are very dramatic mountains that we know of. The Andes Mountains here along the border of South America are again very dramatic mountains. The trench here, oceanic material, the mountains here on the continent. We also find pileups of material on the seafloor in the form of small volcanic islands, which may grow to size, the Philippines in particular. Here are islands which have formed from two plates coming together, very small, much smaller islands here in the Marianas. And Japan is a very good example of an island which is built up at one of these convergent plate boundaries. Well, why do we have mountains? Well, we have a lot of pressure, we have a lot of deformation, and that material just can't all get put back down into the surface of the earth, and it gets squeezed and it builds into big mountains. In the case of the Himalayas, this is kind of a schematic that shows us what happens at these different kinds of plate boundaries. Here we had two pieces of continent coming together. That material is too light to be pushed back down into the earth. Instead, it simply gets squished and we make big mountain ranges like the Himalayas. The Alps also formed in the same way, where Italy was traveling northward into the rest of Europe.
You say material is too light? Is that what
you're saying? Yes, continental material is too light to be pulled back down to the underlying material.
That stuff is all much denser than those big rocks out there.
That's right. Now, the way we see this contrast in density showing up then is when we look at what happens when oceanic material comes together with continental material. Oceanic material is denser than continental crust, so the oceanic material is dense enough to go back down into the earth, and we end up here having a trench forming and then mountains occurring on the continent, in the case like the Andes, where the material that's being forced down in melts. As it melts, it becomes lighter and it floats back up to the surface and makes volcanoes on the surface of the earth. And the rock types associated with this kind of an event are called andesite, named after the Andes Mountains, and they happen to be a very, very common rock type in this part of the country. Now, the other type is the collision between oceanic and oceanic crust, and here again, because of the melting of the material, we form volcanoes on the surface, and these may be reach the surface above sea level and make islands, in the case of, say, the Philippines, or large enough so that they look like Japan. Well, what's going on here? Well, in this part of the country, what do we have? We have a couple of small plates. As I said before, we had a ridge right along here. This is the Pacific plate, and right here we have a small plate called the Juan de Fuca plate. That Juan de Fuca plate is traveling away from that ridge towards North America. And so, again, we have the collision between oceanic crust and continental crust. Well, what other kinds of features do we find associated with convergent plate boundaries? Well, earthquakes. earthquakes were a big part of how we define the outline of these plates, and in fact this part of the country is one which is quite susceptible to earthquakes. Also, we find volcanoes. Now, the kind of volcanism which is associated with these kinds of plate boundaries tends to be very explosive volcanism, builds very tall, spectacular peaks, very steep-sided peaks, because the material that comes out of these volcanoes doesn't flow very fast. So it makes these very dramatic pileups. This is Mount Rainier from the air. Those of you who've been to that area know that Mount Rainier just comes up as this very spectacular peak out of nowhere from very low mountain range around it. This mountain was always known as Fujiyama of North America. Perfectly sided, symmetrical mountain, very steep sided once again. But that fateful, fateful day in 1980 was when Mount St. Helens erupted, and this shows us how very different the kind of eruption was from that we saw taking place in Iceland. Iceland, there was a lot of hot material being thrown up and it was glowing red, but they were able to spray water on it and change the path that it flowed along. Here, the eruption of Mount St. Helens did not have that kind of material coming out. Instead, because of lots of dissolved water and other gases in the hot material as it came to the surface, it caused this very explosive type of eruption instead. And as many of you probably have seen in other pictures, the eruption of Mount St. Helens just flattened everything that was around it. This picture was actually taken just last year, so 10 years after the eruption. And we see that life is coming back into this region. Nothing was living here in this region after the eruption of Mount St. Helens. And I guess sort of we can use one talk as a little promotion for another talk. Some of what I'm going to be talking about in some of my other sessions this week are to look in some more detail at the hazards of this kind of a region, and to look even in great detail at the eruption of Mount St. Helens and some of the specific events associated with it, and to look back at this kind of an area. One of the other mountains of the Cascade Range, which erupted very explosively and even much more explosively than Mount St. Helens, was called Mount Mazama. About 6,000 years ago, it erupted, and all that remains of that once tall peak is then Crater Lake. At this point, I've really sort of finished my show and tell, and we can turn on the lights. I'm more than willing to answer questions about this region in particular, and about sort of plate tectonics and how it applies to things globally. Yeah.
Childish question.
No.
But before the continental drift, all of the land mass was on one side of the globe, right?
That's right.
All the rest was water.
That's right. And it was named Pangaea for all land, the big continental mass right. was. And then the rest of the globe was called Panthalassa for all earth.
Okay.
Now, there probably were very small, what we call microcontinents.
There's a spin. Mm-hmm. Didn't all of this land mass being higher than the water or the ocean floor,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't that put it out of balance? So
except the Earth is very good at developing its sense of balance. And the continental material is lighter than the oceanic
okay.
crust. So that it seems like that distribution should be off, and it is in terms of elevation, but probably in terms of mass distribution,
okay.
that continental mass is sort of balanced by the greater density of the oceanic crust. But the more interesting implications of that are the circulation of the oceans and how they must have been so very different when the continents were distributed very differently. And we know that climatic conditions were very different 100 million years ago. And when we think of the continents being located in different positions, it becomes easier to explain that. I just realized that I went to all this effort of having an overhead here and I didn't put it up. This is just the schematic that shows the west coast of North America and then the San Andreas Fault here, and the small one, the Fuca Plate, Pacific Plate, and here the Cascade Range of mountains. And then in cross-section, you can see that there's this descent of the oceanic plate under North America.
there was a geologist here earlier
that
told us the term for this process where one plate is going down and the other one is coming up, and it was a really neat term that I forgot.
Subduction.
Subduction. That's what I told you.
Yeah. We've been subducted.
Right. Yeah, we use the phrase that the oceanic plates are being subducted beneath the continental plate. That's S-U-B.
Two quick questions. You referred to India as a continent, and that's often usually the thing we talk about as a subcontinent.
Right.
Right.
Well, I mean that in terms of it was a continental mass which rode on a separate plate. We do talk about it as the subcontinent of Eurasia, but in fact, in terms of plate tectonics, it is a separate entity.
The other question is this material recycled itself?
Uh-huh.
And we talked about expansion. Is there, what's going on in the middle? Production of material, or are we?
No, it's more thought of as a convection cell, where the material is going down and then sort of moving along. And in fact, the interior of the Earth is not all solid. Part of the interior of the Earth is in fact liquid, but down in this region where this is cycling, it's what we think of as a plastic solid, and it deforms about like glass deforms. Glass actually flows. And this material in the mantle is flowing similar kind of a pace. And so it's making its way back up to the surface at some point, but hundreds of millions of years.
Slowed by human standards.
And all of this is slow by human standards. The only way that we see much evidence of this is by the natural hazards associated with it. And when the stress that builds up along this fault is released, it happens to create an earthquake. And similarly, as this descending material melts, part of it makes its way back up to the surface. It creates a great big volcano.
One of the things I think is in your list of anomalies is the Madrid Fault.
The New Madrid Fault, right, that runs up sort of along the Mississippi, yes. Everybody wishes they had a better understanding of that. Perhaps one of the biggest enigmas when we look on the surface of the Earth is the Rocky Mountains. Here's this huge, still-forming mountain range, and it isn't at a plate boundary. And it's the only one of its kind in that respect. And so there's obviously something very unusual going on in the middle of North America that's hard to explain that way. And the New Madrid Fault, they believe, is some ancient fault which somehow periodically gets reactivated. And that when the continents initially split apart 200 million years ago, they may have tried to split in a number of different places. And the Atlantic happens to be where it succeeded, but there may have been some fault through the middle of the continent that was associated with that original attempt.
The next big earthquake is going to be supposedly the one in Cuba. I just moved to Tacoma. What's going to happen? What's your prediction?
I'm not. come back tomorrow. No, it's not tomorrow, whenever my next talk is. No, there is a cyclicity which, if you look at this century, looked like it was every 20 years. The problem is, the last time there was an earthquake of any magnitude was in 65, but that wasn't even a great big huge one. These great big huge ones, like the Good Friday earthquake in Alaska in 64, and the Chilean earthquake in 61 or whatever it was, were huge by comparison with any that Puget Sound has felt in human recorded history. But there's studies which suggest that maybe it's a 500-year cyclicity, and it was maybe 200 or 300 years ago. So in our lifetimes, when we were safe in Puget Sound. But there's always great error to this whole thing.
Yeah,
I mean, 500 years plus or minus 200 years could make it tomorrow. So.
Yeah, it's a problem for engineers.
No, actually, it's a greater problem for engineers, because the engineers are the ones who want to know when it's going to happen right now. Because they have to tell the public officials that what that number is.
We have a great theory like Wagner, not that it's the age of self-leadership. The magnetic poles, Are you saying that about every million years, pole just
flips?
Just flips.
And actually, what it looks like happens in terms of the rock record, when we look at the preservation of the magnetism, is that it sort of fades and then comes back in the other orientation in about a 10,000 year time. And it's not that it actually rotates, but that somehow it kind of fades from one and comes back into the other. And that has to do with this part of the Earth, the interior of the Earth, which is molten, and the circulation going on in that molten region. Because the interior of the Earth is primarily iron and nickel, and so that can create a magnetic field, circulation of that.
Now, before all these plates move, where do they say the original land mass was? I mean, is it...
Well, the plates have probably...
North America is now, or where Europe is now, or where?
Well, the plates have probably been moving throughout all of Earth's history. But the last time they were all reassembled together as a single landmass was about 200 million years ago. And it was a landmass which stretched sort of from the North Pole to the South Pole. And one of my slides that showed so the ancient climatic belts showed this reconstruction of the continents. Now, where it was around the globe doesn't really matter. I mean, it just stretched from the North Pole to the South Pole, and Antarctica has stayed almost fixed over the South Pole for the last 200 million years. And then Africa and South America were rotated together, and then Europe and North America were rotated together, and then Europe and
so
North
theoretically
America...
Antarctica is probably the core that didn't move.
Well, at least not in the last 200 million years, but there's pretty good evidence that it moved before that. We would all like to have it fixed relative to something, but all we can do is sort of talk about how they moved relative to one another. There is no internal fix, really, that tells us where they...
Boy,
these 12 credits of geology are really surfacing as questions. It's great.
You talked about the overlaps in that pattern. Did you talk about the gaps?
No, and the gaps, they're harder to explain because there's no evident present feature. I mean, maybe they were gaps before the continents broke apart. Maybe we just don't have everything fit quite together. Maybe there were small scale movements of material out of those spaces. So. Other questions? Oh, yes?
But this means that the things that these creatures are moving is not only which is not constant.
Well, the continents tend to be a single block of themselves, except India is this block which is tacked onto a different plate. So the continents as a whole tend to be on a single plate and not moving relative to one another. But each of those continents is then moving relative to another one.
Well, these plates that move against each other, are a lot of them just moving smoothly?
No.
They're
it tends to be in increments. So the strain pushing. Builds up, that's right. Fancy. I mean, the strain builds up. At, you know, it's a good example. You take something and try and push it along on a table.
Sure.
And you have to push it perhaps for quite a while before it finally moves. And so that's kind of what's happening at the plates.
Obviously there's some that are tighter than others.
That's right. And some are better lubricated by molten material or by liquids which are in them.
So there must be some way to gauge the ones which have a long way to move. And,
Well, one of the ways that we do gauges of things like that is to actually look at the history of where earthquakes have occurred. And to say, particularly San Andreas has been well studied for this, we have this whole long fault, and we know the strain builds up and it has to be released in the form of earthquakes. And if we look at it historically, then it has to take X number of years. You know. And we look along the fault and we see that, well, in the last decade, we've had a lot of small earthquakes all the way along here, and then there's this gap, and then a whole lot of small earthquakes. And so you can say, well, this region is targeted to have an earthquake take place. And the Mexican earthquake, what was that, 1985, had just been that region had just been targeted as what they call a seismic gap, where there hadn't been any earthquakes. And there needed to be one there soon, based on historical, you know, evidence, and it was. The bookstore asks us to mention these. This book is called Fire Mountains of the West, and it deals with the Cascades and this region in terms of what's going on geologically. It has some introductory chapters that deal with plate tectonics and sort of this whole picture here. What I'm doing over the course of the week is starting with this bigger picture and then moving more and more regionally to look at what's been happening.